The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Do you support civilization or do you support barbarism? And unfortunately, the West has shown ever since that it does not support civilization. I mean, here you had, you know, a genocidal attack, unbelievably barbarous. It wasn't just killing people. It was savage and depraved slaughter involving, as we know, not just murder, but rape and beheadings and burning people alive and murdering children in front of their parents, and so on. And you would expect that the civilized world would have said, well, obviously, Israel has to do whatever it takes right. to stop this, because these people who've done this are threatening to do it again and again, until the state of Israel is eliminated, until every Jew is killed, and then they're going to come after the West. Then they're going to they say so. They're going to come after America. They're going to come after the West. They're going to come after the Christian world. They say so in turns. But instead of taking that view, the West turned against Israel, blamed it for effectively its own slaughter, accused it of crimes of which it was innocent and the victim, and so on and so forth. And what my book is saying is this, that in order to understand this appalling reaction to October 7 by the West, one has to understand what the West has done to itself.
A little teaser there from our exclusive interview with conservative author Melanie Phillips. That's coming up in the second half of today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel. Just go to rumble.com/trumpetdaily. If you go to Rumble, make sure you leave us the thumbs up and a nice comment. Or if you watch live, you can join in on the live chat. Lots to get to on today's show. As you saw there, some hard-hitting remarks coming from Melanie Phillips saying that, you know, October 7 was an inflection point. And what followed really did reveal a lot about the West and its reaction and the fact that there's such widespread support for Hamas, for terrorist organizations. You see it all over the world. And her book, which we get into in the interview, The Builder's Stone, she talks about basically the Judeo-Christian foundation, the Jewish foundation in particular, but basically how the West, you know, the United States, Great Britain, the foundational values of the single greatest superpower or the greatest empire in history in the case of Britain, the foundation, the value system was based upon that Judeo-Christian ethic. And you see it in many of the statements from the founding fathers here in the United States. And it's all crumbling, as she brings out in her book. Now, she's optimistic at the end that we can somehow turn it around. But as we've covered on this program, U.S. and Britain in Prophecy comes to mind. I mean, you think of all of this fabulous wealth and prosperity and power that God has gifted to our nations. And he certainly had a hand in selecting or working with so many of those great founders. But we've veered so far away from those foundational principles. And we don't want to be fooled by, you know, empty talk. We even got into, you know, judging by fruits. You know, what are the actions? It's interesting over, and I touched on it yesterday, the Memorial Day holiday here in the United States. Just really, you know, honoring those who made the ultimate sacrifice. And yesterday you had quite a few references to God and to the Bible those foundational principles. And, you know, that's better than nothing. But then you also have to look at the actions right across the board. And as I've said recently on this program, I mean, you have a lot of people very prominent in religion that are talking about a golden age, almost like there's a utopia coming. But we have to look at our actions. We have to consider what we're doing. God says over and again in the scriptures, consider your ways. Look at yourself. Again, just speaking of this foundational Judeo-Christian ethic or system of morality. Listen to, this is President Trump and Vice President Vance, put together, speaking at Arlington Cemetery just yesterday, clip one.
We gather today to honor the incredible service members who rest in glory in this cemetery and burial grounds around the world and in 1,000 lonely places known only to God. In every hour of peril, in every moment of crisis, American warriors have left behind the blessings of home and family to answer their nation's call. They've offered all that they had within them and given their last breaths to each and every one of us that we might live safe and breathe free.
In 1915, President Woodrow Wilson laid the cornerstone of the memorial amphitheater we gather in today. Now, buried within it was a copper box which contained mementos of profound significance to the amphitheater's designers and to our entire country. There were four things: an American flag, a Bible, a copy of our Declaration of Independence, and a copy of the U.S. Constitution. And the objects they chose to dedicate to posterity, those Americans remind us of the values we hold timeless and dear as a nation and as a people. But those values didn't spring from any stonework or time capsule. They were lived out day after day by the people buried in this hallowed cemetery.
Timeless values lived out by those who made the sacrifice for freedom. Well, that is a glorious history. And the founders, as I say, really did talk about religion and morality. We talk about this in our booklet, Character in Crisis. But they basically said, hey, the American experiment's not gonna work in the long run if the foundation of religion and morality crumbles. And this is what Melanie Phillips touches on in her book. This is a quote from The Builder's Stone. It says, "The terrible truth is that the West no longer understands what civilization actually is. Specifically, it no longer understands that civilization is Western, that the West gave birth to it. Instead, our best and brightest have told us for decades that the West was born in the original sins of imperialism and colonialism, racism, and white privilege." I mean, what are we doing to ourselves? As she says, it's not worth fighting or dying for. There you had the president and the vice president talking about what young men, boys in some cases, fought and died for. It was for the Bible, the flag, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. And those founding documents, I mean, they're based on principles in the Bible. Whether it's the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, or the New. What happens if that foundation begins to break apart? She says, so the idea of a just war to achieve victory over evil is anathema because there is nothing worth fighting or dying for. Everything, she says, everything is instead a matter of negotiation and compromise. And she's had some fiery articles this year talking about this administration's willingness to do a deal with the devil. As she said there in the cold open, I mean, they say it. They want to eliminate every single Jew. And then they want to come after the West. And they say it in turn, as she pointed out. They say it repeatedly. They chant it. They sing it. Their children see it on television. The propaganda, the anti-Semitism, the Jew hatred, the spirit of hatred and murder is in the air. And we've been talking about that. Here's, again, Donald Trump from his visit to Arlington Cemetery yesterday, clip two.
We should never forget, even for a moment, that freedom is a gift of the highest cost and peace is won at the most precious price. These extraordinary American heroes and their immense and ultimate sacrifices they offer only the faintest glimpse at the infinite grace we have received from all who laid down their lives for America over the past 250 years. We're going to have a big, big celebration, as you know, 250 years. In some ways, I'm glad I missed that second term where it was, because I wouldn't be your president for that most important of all. In addition, we have the World Cup and we have the Olympics. Can you imagine? I missed that 4 years, and now look what I have. I have everything. Amazing the way things work out. God did that. I believe that, too.
God did that, he says there at the end. You got the 250-year birthday for America, the World Cup, the Olympics, and Donald Trump presiding over the nation during that time, during these historic occasions. And God did it, and he's right. But as we noted all last year, when God intervened to save his life and so on, if God is intervening, if God is miraculously intervening in the affairs of mankind, I mean, we have to dig deep into the Bible and ask some hard, penetrating questions. Why did God do this? Is it because we're pleasing him? Is it because he wants to give us more fabulous blessings? Or is he trying to get our attention? Is he trying to point us in the direction of fulfilled prophecy so that we might consider some other prophecies that are about to be fulfilled? And quite a few of them, they're not very pleasant. How does it, as we keep talking about, I mean, how does it play out ultimately if you sit down and negotiate with the devil? I reminded Melanie Phillips of this interview she had with Foreign Policy a couple weeks ago, where she said this, clip five.
He thinks, I think, that everything in the world that's bad is a potential deal that he could bring off to a successful conclusion. I recall when the Obama administration concluded the disastrous 2015 deal, I remember Donald Trump saying after, in the context of that, that the problem was it was a rotten deal. No, that wasn't the problem. Hmm. The problem was there was a deal, because you cannot make a deal with the devil. Hmm. You cannot make a deal with people whose position is non-negotiable. You can't negotiate. If you try and negotiate with a non-negotiable position, it's not a negotiation, it's a surrender.
That's right. And you've had some few prominent conservative voices over the years that took that as their position. Margaret Thatcher said, never negotiate with a terrorist. Just don't do it. I talked last week about Herbert Armstrong saying, I'm not going to sit down with Yasser Arafat. He's a terrorist. He wants to kill Jews. The problem isn't that it was a bad deal. The problem was that there was a deal in the first place. You don't deal with the devil. My father said back at the time of Obama's JCPOA, the nuke deal with Iran, which basically just delayed the inevitable, so that they could eventually get their nuclear weapon. And my father said, why this nuclear agreement, I believe, is the worst foreign policy disaster ever made by America. That's the subhead to the article. They've broken over 20 nuclear agreements already, every single one. And yet we go ahead and we walk into this and act like they can be trusted. They cannot be trusted. They lie as a way of life. Now, the way Melanie Phillips puts it, is they haven't been brought up on Western values. And our negotiators go into these meetings thinking dialogue can solve everything, thinking that these terrorists across the table think just like they think. You've heard some of the clips. We've played them for you. Witkoff and others. I mean, to desire peace, that's a noble desire. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can't surrender. If you're interested in making peace, surrendering to the enemy is not an option. Sometimes you have to fight for freedom. I mean, isn't that one of the big lessons of Memorial Day? The sacrifice of even human life in order to preserve that foundation, the flag, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bible. The Bible! That's right. Look around this world, and again, what have been our fruits? There's the segment in or section in the Morning Brief about Donald Trump, boosting military spending, and he was talking about this over the weekend. But then at the same time, he's talking about drawing down troops in Southeast Asia, pulling troops out of South Korea. I mean, that's a feature story today at The Trumpet by Jeremiah Jacques. But again, this is something that China must be ecstatic about. Getting rid of American troops. I mean, we've already seen that movement in Europe. And what will China do? How will China fill that vacuum? China's navy, as the Morning Brief says, is now the world's largest with 400 warships. Its Air Force has 2,000 fighter jets compared to America's 1,700. It built 100 new nuclear weapons in 2023, bringing its nuclear arsenal to 600 warheads. I mean, it's catching up to America, in other words. And Joel Hilliker writes, these numbers don't reflect differences in quality. In general, America breaks new ground, which China copies. They steal our technology, and then they can do it more cheaply. This gives America more advanced systems, but China can catch up at a fraction of the cost. My father wrote back in 2016, China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. And if the U.S. draws down, that's only going to empower and embolden China, communist China. We had an article again some years ago. China is steering the world toward war. That's been the fruits. More war. I played that clip yesterday of Donald Trump saying that, Putin's gone crazy. No, actually, that was there from the beginning, the craziness, the tyranny, the abuse, the murder, the killing, the destruction. Putin's just lobbing one missile after another into civilian zones in the Ukraine right now. The Express over in the UK, the Russian press had declared Donald Trump's peace deal is dying a slow death. As a key ally of Vladimir Putin mocked Western ceasefire plans by posting a map showing almost all of Ukraine occupied by Kremlin forces. They're mocking Donald Trump. And Trump finally came out and criticized Putin. He didn't call him a nice gentleman this past weekend. Now he says he's crazy. So at least there's a better understanding there. But war is escalating in Ukraine. It's not. Donald Trump, remember, came in saying day one, it's over. Day one, the hostages in Gaza are returned. Melanie Phillips has quite a lot to say about those hostages in our interview that's coming up here in the second half of the show. But first, play this montage on the Ukraine war escalation, clip 7.
Well, the Kremlin has been stepping up its assault on Ukraine, launching over the weekend its biggest drone attack since the war began.
The New York Post reporting a U.S. Marine who fought in Iraq and voluntarily deployed to Ukraine was killed in one of Russia's drone strikes during the frontline mission.
But this is vintage Putin. I mean, Putin is a war criminal. He's targeting civilians. That is a war crime. But he has always done this. In 2000, when he took over, he targeted innocent civilians in Chechnya, which was, he believed there were radicals there threatening Russia. And he went in there. Certainly, there were military targets, but he took down entire villages of civilians. No military targets. He went into Grozny, their principal city, destroyed entire neighborhoods. Tens of thousands of people killed as a result of his bombing and artillery that he used on those civilians. In 2015 and 16, he did carpet bombing of Aleppo. He used chlorine bombs. He used cluster munitions that don't self-detonate like the United States does. If they're on the ground for a period of time. He used deep penetration bombs to go into underground hospitals and kill the people. It was the largest carpet bombing air campaign ever conducted since World War II. This is who Putin really is. Yes, I think it's been long enough now to know full well he's not coming to the negotiating table and willing to do a ceasefire. The president has given him every opportunity to do this. And the president's running out of patience. I agree with him.
Yeah, and we do, too. But look, there's been a long line of U.S. presidents, diplomats, peacemakers that have looked into Putin's eyes and have shaken his hand and have said, I trust him. I trust him. I mean, that clip I played yesterday, Donald Trump over the weekend said, I've known Putin for a long time. I can't believe what's happening here. He's gone crazy. All you have to do is look at the track record. Look at the actions, as you just heard there. Look at the behavior. Look at the fruits. This article on Russia saying the peace deal is dead. Says the Moscow-based daily newspaper ran an editorial on current ceasefire negotiations, commenting that it believed the president's energy charge had gone flat, speaking of Trump, that is, and that it would soon become obvious, even to Mr. Trump, that any deal was in its death throes. Any deal. Everywhere you look, there's just more war. In the morning brief, Mr. Hilliker writes about the Russia's response to, hey, well, how about if the Vatican gets in there and makes peace? And Russia's like, no, thanks. I think now we want all of Ukraine. This is Kristi Noem, the secretary of the Homeland Department of Homeland Security, whatever you call it. She was in Israel. So finally, we got a U.S. official that reaches out to Israel or that pays a visit to Israel. And she was talking about some of the victims of October 7, the slaughter, the savagery. Listen to what she had to say in Israel on Memorial Day, clip 3.
Now, yesterday at the Western Wall, I prayed Jeremiah 31. And Jeremiah 31 says, thus saith the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Thus says the Lord to us, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is reward in your work, declares the Lord, and they shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children shall come back to their own country. I ask that God may bless Israel and that God may continue to bless their families, wrap his arms of comfort around them during this time. President Trump extends his greetings and his grief to all of you, and he stands with you as we fight this hatred in the world and know that Yaron and Sarah's lives will be of significance and will matter and will bring a unity among us that will help us defeat our enemies. May God bless Israel and may God continue to bless the great United States of America.
It's interesting that she went through Jeremiah 31. There's a section in my father's booklet on Jeremiah under the subhead Rachel's Tomb. And you know, you can look in the book of Genesis and see how that Rachel was buried in Bethlehem. And my father says in that section of the booklet that people are probably right as far as where they identify the tomb. I mean, this is from thousands of years ago. And then you've got other passages in Scripture referring to her weeping and her tomb. And what is this about? I mean, what's God trying to show us? In the booklet, my father says, Jeremiah prophesied about Rachel's tomb. It is an end time prophecy. It's actually prophetic. That's the significance here. I mean, there is hope. There is hope for Israel to be regathered, as that same section of Scripture brings out. But that's coming after. That's coming after the Great Tribulation. That's coming after the return of Jesus Christ. What happens before? Well, there's going to be a lot of weeping, a lot of mothers weeping, as that prophecy brings out. My father goes through those verses in Jeremiah 31, and he says this: Rachel is symbolically pictured as losing her entire family. It will be so bad that she cannot be comforted. Imagine a mother with a large family losing all her children at one time. Imagine, well, some can identify with that in Israel, as Melanie Phillips brings out in our interview. It touches everyone. It's just a small country of 9-10 million people. And when Hamas comes in there and slaughters 1,200 Jews, I mean, chances are you, if it's not one of your own, you know someone who had a relative or a family member get slaughtered. Like a wild animal. What happens when that is carried out on a large scale, as I've covered already in recent programs? I mean, if Hamas had the firepower, do you think they would have stopped at 1,200? Well, look at China's building all these nukes. Now Germany's in the rush to build nukes. Vladimir Putin is escalating the war effort in Ukraine. Everywhere you look, there's more war. But there is hope. And it's even in that same passage, Jeremiah 31. There is hope in the return of Jesus Christ. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with our exclusive interview with conservative author Melanie Phillips. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Daily News, Bible Prophecy. See the connection on The Trumpet Daily. Are you feeling overwhelmed by the flood of news and information? You need something to sift the news and bring you only what matters most. You need The Trumpet Daily. You also need something to help you understand not just what's happening now, but what will happen next. You need The Trumpet Daily. Only The Trumpet Daily accurately matches daily news to precise Bible prophecies. Because Bible prophecy is the only tool up to the task of sifting the news down to what's important and showing you what will happen next. Join host Stephen Fleury every weekday. Go to TrumpetDaily.com.
Melanie Phillips, welcome back to The Trumpet Daily.
Very good to see you again. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, as we were just discussing, you were on the program back in 2019. You've seen some of our exhibits over the years. I think Brent gave you a tour of the excavation sites back in 2017. You've been on our campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. You spoke before quite a large gathering, and then met later, I think, with our staff, and we had lunch together. So
That's right.
You're definitely one of our favorite journalists, and you've been really firing off some pretty powerful articles of late. And of course, your book, The Builder's Stone, just came out this year as well. So we do have a lot to talk about, and I want to get to your book as well. But right now you're on, I guess you're out promoting your book, and you're in the States at the moment?
That's right. I'm currently in Los Angeles, and I've been in Washington, D.C., and in New York and in Boston, talking about the themes of my book, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to start with, it was a recent interview, I think maybe Foreign Policy sat down with you, and you were talking about the attempts of the Trump administration to talk to the mullahs, in this case, Iran, and to try to make peace deals. And then you made a really interesting statement, similar to some of the things that we said years ago. My father talked about the Obama's nuclear deal with Iran being the worst foreign policy disaster in America's history. And you mentioned that at that time, Donald Trump said that it was a bad deal. But then, as you said, it wasn't that it was a bad deal. It's that they had a deal at all, that you shouldn't even really sit down with people like that who don't want peace, but who want to destroy you. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit further?
Yes, I think this has become quite troubling to myself and to several people who are very concerned about Iran and the threat it poses, not just to Israel, but to America and to the free world. Because Donald Trump has been very clear. He has said several times now that Iran is not going to get the bomb. And that if Iran doesn't voluntarily agree to dismantle its entire nuclear program, then America will do it for it by force, that Donald Trump would prefer not to do that, but ultimately he will do that. And that was very clear, and people in Israel were very cheered by this because, as you said, we've all lived through the disastrous 2015 Obama brokered nuclear deal with Iran, which lifted sanctions, enabled vast amounts of money to be funneled in to finance Iran's power grab in the region, wage its terrorist war against Israel and the world, and proceed to assemble what it needs to assemble, particularly uranium enrichment, to get a bomb. And my understanding, and I know nothing other than what I'm reading in the public prints, is that it is at the point of making a bomb. It is no longer useful to talk about stopping uranium enrichment. It's enriched it. And it's at the point now of working out how to fit warheads to missiles. So this is, to put it mildly, a few seconds before midnight.
Right.
Now, what Donald Trump said originally was fine, except that he does believe, in my view, that he can do deals that nobody else can do. He seems to believe that all conflicts in the world are potential deals which can be done if he is doing them. His problem, as I recall, with the 2015 Obama deal was that it wasn't a good deal, that he could have done a better deal. Now, this to me is a terrible mistake because I don't doubt Donald Trump's skills as a deal maker, but there are some agendas which are simply non-negotiable. The Ayatollahs of Iran the people who run the regime are governed by a religious ideology which holds that if they produce the apocalypse, they will bring to earth the Shia Messiah, the 12th Imam. Now, if you have people who believe that it's a religious duty to wage war on the West and to destroy Israel and the Jews, then there's no negotiation. There's no negotiation with that agenda. There's no negotiation possible that is not seen by them as a surrender and as a kind of inspiration to ratchet up their aggression. So this is what worries me. President Trump has recently said that negotiations with Iran, which are proceeding, are going very well. He has hailed their great intelligence. Well, of course they're great. They're vastly intelligent. They are probably the greatest multidimensional geostrategic chess players in the world. They appear to be running rings around the American administration, if one believes that the Trump administration is really thinking that a deal can be made. There is no deal that can be made with these people because their agenda is non-negotiable, and they have simply to be defeated, and their nuclear program, the entire infrastructure of that program, needs to be destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of deals, too, you had a column back at the start of this year. This was when President Trump was coming into office. His inauguration was on January 20th, and he was really pressuring Israel through Qatar to have some kind of a deal that would presumably release the hostages and there'd be a ceasefire and so on and so forth. And at that time, you talked about, you know, making a deal with the devil, basically. And you also talked about how there were Israelis wondering how President Trump could betray Israel this way with such a lopsided agreement. Here again, besides my father, I just was not seeing really any commentary along those lines. And I forget when you wrote that column, but it was, I think, in January or February.
Yes, I wrote it shortly after this occurred. I think it was either on the inauguration or very, very soon after that, through President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, the administration pressured Israel to have a ceasefire, which was disastrous. Because a ceasefire released pressure on Hamas. It enabled them to regroup and to recover from the damage that Israel was doing. What was enforced upon Israel was to allow into Gaza much, much more humanitarian aid, most of which was stolen and appropriated by Hamas in order to service their war machine. And, you know, when the war resumed in Gaza, Israel was at a disadvantage. Hamas had regrouped. So this was disastrous. And again, it's the same principle that, you know, all conflict is amenable to negotiation. I mean, my view about the hostage negotiation, which has now gone on for 19 months, is that, you know, the Hamas took the hostages for one reason only, that they knew that this was the ultimate weapon which would enable them to ensure that Israel did not ultimately defeat them. Because ultimately they held the, if I can use the metaphor now, the phrase, they held the trump card, which was the hostages. Israel would, you know, go to great lengths, to put it mildly, to not have them harmed. And the negotiations were, in my view, a farce, because America was negotiating with Qatar, as if Qatar was an honest broker in this, as if it was an independent interlocutor. It's not. Qatar is, to all intents and purposes, Hamas. It funds Hamas. It shields all its senior operatives. And it was an absolute farce that they were negotiating effectively with Hamas, which was then able, through its notional proxy, Qatar, to dictate the terms, which meant that they would never, ever release the hostages because they always had to have this weapon against Israel. So we saw some of them were released, but that was when Israel was putting tremendous military pressure on them. So they kind of tactically kind of withdrew at that point and released right. some of the hostages.
Yeah.
But the idea that they would voluntarily let them go, you know, the idea that, you know, if they were finally to decide that, you know, the game is up, they'll kill them.
Yeah.
Because their only value to them is to stop Israel from ever winning. And if they were ever to think that Israel was winning and that, you know, there was no chance that Hamas could survive, they'll kill them.
Yeah.
So this is a terrible thing. And, you know, Qatar is Hamas. We saw that, was it just a few weeks ago, when President Trump did the deal behind Israel's back to release Eden Alexander, the American-Israeli hostage. And we saw that Qatar basically snapped its fingers and he was released. Now, Qatar could have released got the hostages released at any time. If America, if the Biden administration at that time had said on October the 8th, and if the Trump administration had said, when the Trump administration came in, had said to Qatar, unless you release all the hostages or all the remaining hostages within 24 hours unharmed, we remove our whatever it is, their airbase in Doha, whatever it is they have in Qatar, mm-hmm. and you're out of here. We don't care that you are funding all our universities. We don't care that you're funding all kinds of stuff in America. As far as we're concerned, you will be treated as a rogue state. The war would have ended that mm-hmm. day. Mm-hmm. The hostages would have been released. neither the Biden nor the Trump administrations has chosen to do so. This is very, very troubling indeed.
Yeah.
It suggests that the financial ties between Qatar and America, and between Qatar and my home country of London, of Britain, are so extensive that the West can't extricate itself, or chooses not to extricate itself,
right,
from a relationship with Qatar, which is just simply too lucrative.
Yeah. We've played this clip. It's from 2017. So this is right as President Trump is coming into office the first time around. And he was, I think, on the White House lawn. And this is what he had to say about Qatar. Play that one for us, Sam.
The time had come to call on Qatar to end its funding. They have to end that funding and its extremist ideology in terms of funding.
And he also said in that same speech that even, you know, that we're going to, the easy way is to appease and the hard way is to confront this, Qatar and some of these other sponsors of terrorism. But he talked about going after those that even sponsored terrorism, you know, morally, or like got behind it, you know, with their support, you know, verbally, of financing, obviously. But that's 2017. I mean, you had said that we're now so entangled in these financial connections with countries like Qatar. Do you feel like it's mostly just money and deal making that would explain why the thinking has changed so much, even for conservatives, Republicans?
Well, I assume that's a very large part of the problem. I mean, there are a number of people, including Mr. Witkoff, who seem to have extensive ties and obligations to Qatar. So that must have an influence. But I think there's also another factor which has arrived with the second Trump administration, which is that he has said many times he wants to be the president that brings peace. He wants to be the president that ends war. He doesn't want to have violence. Now, that is a very laudable aim. We all want to have an end to war. We all want peace. But you don't want to have the kind of peace that comes from a surrender to people who are going to wipe out Israel and kill Jews and then, as a precursor to destroying the West. That's not peace with justice. That's not the real peace. That's a surrender to an unconscionable agenda. You know, what President Trump said, his remarks about Qatar being the funder of terror and so on was absolutely correct. But I think this has been complicated. His view has been complicated by his demonstrable determination to be the president that ends war, that doesn't do violence.
Yeah.
And I think this is getting in the way, because while none of us wants war, none of us wants violence, if you've had negotiations and they've ended in disaster and worse, if you can see that the enemy is using negotiation as a lever to continue to ratchet up its aggression, then you have no alternative sometimes but to wage war, but to use violence to achieve your noble aim.
Right. You said in that column back around the inauguration that Donald Trump does not want war under his watch. And I mean, just the fact that he's openly stating that to everybody, it just kind of takes away any leverage that the United States might have in a negotiation.
Exactly.
Because if you know, Putin or the mullahs or whoever knows that there's not going to be, you know what to pay, as Donald Trump said that there would be if the hostages weren't released, then again, they can just keep playing the United States, right?
Well, exactly. And the irony is that President Trump is in danger of ending up in exactly the same position as his foe, President Biden, who, you know, he mocked, and everybody who is right thinking mocked, for having produced a terrible situation in which America was no longer the leader of the free world, but was being made a fool of by Iran and other countries, by Russia, by China, by, you know, the bad actors in the world, who perceived correctly that under the Democrat administration, America was no longer prepared to fight in defense of its values. And then along comes President Trump, who obviously, you know, is from a completely different mindset, But he wants to avoid war and bring peace. So he ends up in the same position as his mortal foes on the left, for whom, you know, the liberal leftist world, you know, believes that war is a terrible thing, which it is, but war is so terrible that it never solves anything. How many times have I heard people on the left say this in the last few months? War never solves anything. I mean, what do they think happened in 1940? When, you know, the Allies eventually won the war against the Nazis, because the only reason why the free world is still free is because war was waged against the Nazi regime. And so this is completely ridiculous, but the left hold it as a kind of article of faith that you don't do war, you do conflict resolution, you do negotiation, you do compromise, you do peace processes, that in a fight between God and the devil, you split the difference. That's where the left is. And it's odious. It mm-hmm. ends up supporting and promoting evil in the world. Now, you know, the Republican Party and President Trump come from a different perspective, but he's ending up in the same place, because if he won't do war, he won't use the mechanism of war to achieve the most righteous of ends and most necessary of ends, then he's going to end up in exactly the same place as the left, in being the handmaidens of evil.
Right. Last week you had a column on the split in the MAGA movement. Is this something that was inspired by even your visit to the United States here the last many days that you've been over here, or is this something you had been thinking about for a while?
It's certainly something I've been thinking about for a while, and I've been much informed by conversations I've had on my trip here at the moment to the United States, that there does seem to be a split in the MAGA movement, because, you know, President Trump was brought to power basically by the wishes of millions and millions of extremely, what I would call middle America, centrist Americans, who perceive that under the Democrats, who were in power, both at national and local level, America had lurched into a kind of insanity, mm-hmm. In which, you know, there was no such thing as truth. Everything was a matter of opinion, in which you had a victim culture in which people dodged moral responsibility for their actions and blamed people who were the victims of what they were doing. You had anarchy on the streets, which was lauded, you know, the Black Lives Matter an onslaught upon the rule of law, upon the police, upon white people, was lauded. You had the demonization of white people by black people on the absolutely ludicrous grounds that this was anti-racism. There's nothing more racially prejudiced than damning everybody on the basis of the color of their skin. I mean, it was monstrous. And you had other stuff, you know, the transgender madness, the fact that, you know, the border, there was no longer a policed border, that, you know, you had mass illegal immigration. And if you don't have a policed border, you don't have a nation. A nation exists within a border. All those sorts of things, I think that people were entirely right and sort of sane and centrist to object to. And that's what brought President Trump to power, because those people perceived that the whole political establishment, the Democratic Party most certainly, but also the kind of more mainstream Republican Party, had gone along with all this and had promoted it and gone along with it. And so they elected President Trump as an outlier, as a disruptor, a disruptor of a political way of thinking that was driving America into rack and ruin. And so I thought that was great. And, you know, that's why he was brought to power. But in the same movement, there are people who are not, I would call, centrist at all. They are people who have a view of the world which is essentially conspiratorial, which believes that the world, they seem to think that the world is so perplexing and so inexplicable, it can only be explained by conspiracy theory. And this is because they are fundamentally isolationists. They seem to believe that, you know, America is this vast place which is entirely self-sufficient, which doesn't need anything from anywhere else and can get along absolutely fine without recourse to the rest of the world at all, because it is so big and it is so productive and it is so wonderful in every regard. And consequently, if things aren't going absolutely right, like the aftershocks of the October 8th, sorry, 2008 financial crisis, and also the humiliations and worse of America's entanglement in first Vietnam, and then in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which humiliated America, which, you know, young people died. For what, people ask themselves. I think this embittered a lot of people, and it made them think that there must be some force that was actually producing this terrible situation in which America had kind of lost its way. And so that leads those people down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theory, which leads them straight into rank Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, in which they alight upon the people who have always been blamed as a conspiracy against the interests of everybody else, in circumstances where so many people can't explain what's going on. And so those people are represented in the MAGA movement, and to my horror, they are represented in the Trump administration. It would appear that President Trump wants to ride both horses. He sees that both wings of this movement are necessary for him to maintain a majority support in the population. And that is very troubling, because I think that those people are giving him very bad advice. I think those are the people who are saying to him, you must make a deal with Iran, that Israel is the problem, that it's Israel's fault that there is war, and all that kind of stuff. I surmise, I don't know, I'm just drawing a conclusion from what I have read, what I've thought about, what I've seen, what I'm being told. But that, I think, is very troubling. I think that split is very troubling.
Well, yeah, there have been conservative commentators that have made some pretty stunning statements about the Jews. And just it is shocking to see this play out, even, as you say, in the MAGA movement and even in the West Wing. I mean, this probably explains why, you know, there's evidently a rift between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, he went on that trip last week or week before, didn't visit Israel, had all these wonderful things to say about, you know, the new leader in Syria and Qatar and all that. And then J.D. Vance also skipped Israel. So from you spend a lot of your time in Israel. What's, you know, what's Israel's take on the relationship right now between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, I think a lot of people are very, very worried. When President Trump was elected second time round, unless you were a liberal stroke leftist who hates Prime Minister Netanyahu, hates what they call the right, and sees everything through that prism, unless you're one of those people, Israelis were immensely, to put it mildly, relieved by President Trump's election, because they felt they'd dodged a bullet. They felt that if Kamala Harris had won, if the Democratic Party had again been in power, Israel would have been in a very difficult position indeed. It was bad enough under President Biden, but under Kamala Harris, it was perceived that the Democratic Party would be unleashed in its extremist attitude of hostility to Israel. So everyone was very thrilled and relieved to see President Trump back in the White House. And now they're not sure. They believe, I think, that President Trump's, I believe that President Trump's feelings towards Israel remain warm and supportive. And his attitude towards the Jewish people is extremely warm and supportive. I see no reason to doubt that whatsoever. But I think that whether it's because these people that I've been talking about, these conspiracy theorists, these anti-Semites in his administration, whether it's they who are, you know, having words in his ear and influencing him, or whether it's because, you know, he said, I want to have, you know, peace in the region, like as soon as I come into office. And it's not happened. Mm-hmm. And he's the kind of man who would be very impatient
right.
with that. And he wouldn't sort of necessarily think it all through and think there are the following complex reasons why this hasn't happened and that hasn't happened. He probably thinks, you know, Netanyahu is just dragging his feet, which is what he's basically said.
Yeah.
You know, why isn't this war finished already?
Right.
There are many reasons why the war isn't finished already. Partly it's because America is putting pressure on Israel to drag its feet because of the hostage negotiations, partly because the hostages are still there.
Right.
And because Israel is terrified of having them, of causing them to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
It complicates the matter enormously having hostages there. And there are all kinds of reasons like that, some of which we know, some of which we can guess at, some of which we have no idea about. But I would guess that President Trump is just being very impatient. He wants the war done. He wants it all done and dusted because he wants to, you know, to proceed to the next stage in bringing peace to the region, which is a fine ambition. But I suspect he's the kind of guy who just, you know, he brushes aside the very reasonable explanations of why this has not been possible. And starts blaming people who are doing their best to make it possible, but are finding it very difficult.
Yeah.